Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro, and this week my guest is science communicator, Dr. Kiki Sanford. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be back on the show, John.
I love having you on the show. For those listeners who may have missed the previous shows, we did the original Background Mode about a year ago, and you told me about your career and your PhD work and all the background stuff that we do on the show. And then we got into some science stuff, and it was so cool that I invited you back on early in 2017 for just a geek talk about science, and it was fabulous. And I enjoyed doing that so much with you because you're so well schooled on science, both the technique of science because of your doctorate and your show and your awareness of science, that you're just delightful to have. So welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Any chance I can get to have a geek conversation, I am in.
Yes.
I'm happy to be here.
Listeners, Dr. Kiki does This Week in Science. It's a weekly hour-long web and radio show presenting a humorous, often opinionated, and irreverent look at the week in science and technology. In each episode, TWIS discusses the latest cutting-edge news on topics such as genetic engineering, stem cells, cybernetics, epigenetics, space exploration, neuroscience, microbiology, and a show favorite, Countdown to World Robot Domination.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this wonderful technique of educating and inspiring at the same time. It's really cool.
Thank you.
So since you are such a great science communicator, I thought we'd just dig right in. We've selected some topics to talk about. So let's talk about science.
Yay. Okay, let's.
All right. So the first topic on my list is a recent article I read about how companies that build voice assistants, sometimes they're referred to as artificial intelligence agents or speaker assistants, have personal voices, personal names like Alexa and Cortana and Siri. And this may have started off in science fiction whimsy, but it kind of contradicts the history of science fiction on Star Trek, in which we talk to the computer as computer. And this author argued that it's really insidious the way companies have taken these agents, which aren't really self-conscious, and they're barely intelligent, but they can talk to us, and giving them friendly, especially female names that make them approachable, easy to talk to, and easy to buy things from. What do you think about all of this?
Yeah, well, it's a marketing ploy, and the whole purpose is to make you, as you said, feel like this computer is approachable. Call it Alexa, call it Siri, whatever you call it. Don't call it computer, because that might make you more reticent to actually interact with it. And so these companies, Apple, Google, Amazon, they want you to bring these devices into your life and your home and to make them an integral part of how you interact. And
isn't that just good marketing?
It's marketing, yeah. And they're trying to get as much data from you as possible. You know, what are you interested in? And they are taking all these things that you ask for, questions you ask of Siri or Alexa. You know, you want Alexa to buy you something, put toilet paper on my shopping list, Alexa. Or if you want to ask Siri what the capital of, you know, some foreign country is. You know, these are questions, everything it goes into a database. Maybe not that's you, your information personally, but it gets tallied, and that's how they figure out how to sell you things better.
You know, companies might do things for reasonable marketing and customer-related reasons to make their products more approachable. When I think about that, I think about unintended consequences and future evolution. For example, could it be that in this process of innocent marketing, we come to be so dependent on these quote creatures unquote that we subtly and unknowingly, like a frog getting boiled in water, lapse into a situation where we might start taking the advice and counsel of these machines seriously, like, you really ought to do this, or you really ought to think that?
Yeah,
is it
well
bad
I mean
for
it's
our
a,
kids
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we should protect our privacy. I'm a person who's taken Google into my life. I use Chrome. I read the news that Google feeds to me in my morning news feed. But at the same time, I haven't brought an Alexa. I haven't brought any of these boxes into my home because I think my house is a private space. And I don't want that invasion of my privacy by companies. You know, if I'm going to use my computer to order something on Amazon, I'm going to go and directly do that.
You think
I'm
like
not,
I do.
Yeah, I'm not going to give up my privacy for, you know, this ease. You know, it just and we're getting tricked, really. These companies are taking over and injecting themselves into so much of our lives, and it's just for our comfort, right?
I like to feel like I'm in control, that I can sit down with a web browser and navigate to what I want and buy what I want when I'm ready to buy it with no ambiguity or concerns. I have an Amazon Dot, but the red ring is always on. And I wrote when I got it that if I ever found out that the microphone was listening to me, even though the red ring was on, it's going right back into the box.
Exactly.
But I haven't heard any stories about that. So I think Amazon's taken that part pretty seriously. When the red ring is on, the microphone is muted. It's not listening on the internet. So that's how I handle mine. I turn off the red ring when I want to experiment with it. Maybe I want to know something more about how the Dot works and how Alexa works. I'll turn the red ring off and I'll chat with it, maybe learn a few things. But when I'm done, that red ring goes right back on again.
Yeah, I just hope that as I raise my son, he's 6 years old now, you know, he loves the iPad as so many kids his age do. And I just hope I can teach him, you know, about privacy and how to protect it and not just to take these apps and these devices at face value when they are offered by a company. And it's like, oh, the company's being nice and they're offering me this thing that, oh, I really need it. And it's like, no, you don't really need it. It might make your life a little bit easier, but you don't need it. We're being tricked. We're being tricked. And that AI is taking all of our information and integrating it into their systems.
It's going to get worse.
Yes, it is.
World
yes,
domination.
It is.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm always on record as, you know, I'm on the robot side. You know, I might try and protect myself now, but you know, I am totally on the robot side when they come and dominate the world. Oh yeah, hey, I was always with you.
Yeah, I was always with you. Yeah, right. I'm your friend.
I'm your friend. Don't attack me. I'm here.
All right, we got to move on. So I wanted to ask you about what your perceptions are about the science budget. One of the things that worries me is that when there are particular elements of science that are uncomfortable, like global climate change or stem cell research, that political irritation with science becomes more broad instead of specific. In other words, the politician doesn't say, well, because I disagree politically about global change, I'm going to still respect everything else that's going on in science because those things are trustworthy. I just disagree with a few things. But is that how it really goes, or do politicians tend to try to undermine science as a whole thing in order to focus on specific things? What do you think?
I think it goes both directions. I think there are broad budgetary restrictions that take place where, you know, things like the NSF budget, the NIH budget, money for NASA, you know, when they're determining the budget for the next year, you know, the grants that these organizations give out currently only, I think it's NSF is something like 8% of grant applicants actually get a grant from the National Science Foundation, only 8%. And I think that number recently went down lower to something like 6%. So it's like this shot in the dark that researchers are making to try and get funded by the government to do their research. And that number, it just kind of keeps going down and being spread thinly. And what happens is then political bias comes into potentially determining which grants actually get funded. You know, where is the most important place to spend our tax dollars. There's definite political bias in that aspect. So how much does NSF get? How much does NIH get? NASA? And then like the EPA, the Department of Energy, you know, those budgets fund a lot of basic science. USDA, FDA, CDC.
You know what amuses me? Every presidential election, there's some candidate who talks about doing away with the Department of Energy. And what they don't know is that the Department of Energy, amongst a million other things, annually certifies the reliability of our nuclear weapons, which is a defense issue. That's one thing it does. It's a stewardship program.
It also has, the Department of Energy has massive research programs as well that are related to energy production. And it's not just nuclear weapons, which is a national security issue, but also energy infrastructure for our entire country, which is, again, a national security issue. Mm-hmm. There are so many things that the Department of Energy is responsible for that we take for granted. And if that budget is slashed, it's going to have major, major effects down the road on things like national security, which is, you know, that's not okay. But then there's the other side of it, which is not budgetary in nature, but how these departments, how these governmental organizations get staffed. And if you look now, the Department of Energy, the EPA, the Office of Science and Technology Policy within the government, they're not staffed. They have not been staffed since Trump took office as president. He just hasn't made it a priority to put people in place to make these organizations run smoothly. So there are empty offices. There are people who were supposed to kind of go at the end of Obama's administration, but they're still there because nobody was nominated to take their place. And so there's a lot of stuff there.
Yeah.
It might help a little bit, but there's a lot of stuff going on there, which, you know, well, as you may have seen politically, it's the political nominees that get put in place. We have people who don't believe in climate change who are now responsible for the Environmental Protection Agency, people who think that we need to get rid of our national wildlife areas so that we can have more mining, responsible for the Environmental Protection Agency. And I mean, this stuff boggles my mind, but this is the political game, right?
You mentioned climate change. Yeah, it is. One of the topics on my list, I get the feeling, and I'm not a practicing scientist anymore, but I kind of get the feeling in these days, as an editor at the Mac Observer and observing what's going on, that people are confusing climate change with local air effects and weather and temperatures. In other words, since it snowed last night, there can't be global warming. And they ignore the fact that there are temperature and weather extremes coming, caused billion-dollar events, fires, earthquakes, not earthquakes, fires and storms like Hurricane Irma and Harvey, and that the ocean plays a significant role in trying to moderate the effects of the planet by absorbing the carbon dioxide, and clouds play a significant factor in reflecting sunlight or keeping the warmth in.
Yeah, and water ice also reflects a lot of sunlight and changes the temperature of the oceans, keeps the temperature of the oceans cool in the Arctic.
Right. So do you think, how is it that we can explain to people that it's not global warming in the sense of looking out the window and seeing what the temperature is today, but rather global climatic effects based on ice and clouds and ocean currents and temperatures and salinity of the water and the viability of the plankton that create oxygen? I mean, that's a massively complex subject. And how do we communicate that? Have you been working on that?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about climate change all the time. My co-host Blair, she works at the San Francisco Zoo, and this is something she focuses on a lot, about the idea of educating people about climate change and how you communicate these complex ideas in a way that people can understand. So the big thing is trying to get first that difference in understanding of weather versus climate, where weather is what's happening in your local area. It's like the day of the week, right? Climate are these much larger systemic trends that occur. And when we talk about global climate change or global warming, we're not talking about your neighborhood or your town being hotter last summer. We're talking about the entire globe, the average temperature of the atmosphere going up, right? And so it's the difference between taking a look at a single day versus a single year, and how that the difference that is.
Things like the viability of plankton, the coral reefs, the acidity of the water brought up by the absorption of carbon dioxide, the viability of animals in the sea, and the ecology of the entire planet Earth. And since the ocean is, 68% of our surface, we have to think about the health of the ocean, and we don't think about that too much sitting on dry land the way we do.
I know. So many of us aren't near the ocean, right? You might live inland. You might be in Nebraska and you never go see the ocean. maybe you eat fish occasionally, but it's not something that you really think about all the time. And interesting story that just came out this week, we talked about on This Week in Science last night, is this new analysis suggesting that as the global temperature increases, we're going to see more of the ice in the Arctic Ocean melting. And as you have less white ice reflecting sunlight and keeping the water beneath it cool, you're going to have more dark exposed water to the solar rays and solar energy. It's going to then absorb that solar energy and it's going to warm. And the net effect of that is that we're going to see atmospheric pressure ridges getting stuck over the Northwest, so pushing warm air up from the south, warm dry air specifically up from the south, and keeping much of the West Coast dry and potentially subject to more drought over time.
Yeah, and so we've seen that. The big fires in California were in the news this week, and here we are almost Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost Christmas in California. Southern California is on fire. Just a month ago, the Bay Area was on fire. And the potential fallout over not hundreds of years from now, when people talk about climate change, it's like, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now, this is what's going to happen. We're talking a couple of decades. We're already in the summer months seeing a lot of melting ice in the Arctic, and it's getting to be, it's increasing.
Oh, the other thing people think is that it's these effects are linear, but they tend to be additive and become exponential and grow and feed each other. So it can happen fast.
Yes, and it can happen quickly. And so they're thinking that it's going to be only a couple of decades, and the Arctic ice is going to start melting much more, and it's going to decrease rainfall in California specifically by about 10 to 15%. And this isn't just going to have we have less rain in California. This is going to have ecological impacts that will affect the economy in the West.
Right, and there's political effects of the North Pole.
And
sea lanes open up in the North Atlantic, in the Arctic, there's going to be political movement towards drilling, towards controlling the sea lanes, towards the underground mineral and oil properties under what was used to be ice. And so there's we're scrambling for those nations that are border on the Arctic, Russia, Canada, Norway, and so on. So that's going to bring some global friction.
It absolutely will. And I think the big thing to remind people is that as much as we need to, you know, act local, we do need to think globally. It is a huge system. We don't live in a point that is unaffected by other points on a map. It is a connected network. It is a system. And when one thing changes, something else changes, and it's going to fluctuate. And we are at a point now where we've had enough of an impact on the environment, and we continue to, that it's that we really need to think proactively about what we can do.
You know what else is going to have
the future?
You know what else is going to have an impact? Finances. We got to take
finances.
A break. Got to do a commercial. Folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some fun topics we have on the list to talk to Dr. Kiki Sanford about. But we'll be right back. Stay with us. We'll be gone in 60 seconds, and we're right back.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you. I'm talking to science communicator Dr. Kiki Sanford. All right. I want to ask you about some fun little piecemeal topics here. Red wine. I love red wine. I love Pinot Noir. Red wine has been in the news. It's always in the news. First we hear it's bad, then we hear it's good, and then we hear it's bad. A couple weeks ago, I saw a news report that said that you shouldn't drink much wine at all, if any, because of the risks. And that kind of goes in the face of what we've been hearing in the past about the resveratrol and the healthful effects of red wine. So what's the latest news?
There's a lot of sugar in wine. So, I mean, wine comes from grapes, right? And it is an alcohol. So there's a lot of sugar in wine. But there are positive components of the wine as well. So, you know, this if you are in kind of a questionable zone for your health and you're wondering how wine is going to affect you, I mean, do you have metabolic disease? Do you have diabetes? Is there some reason that you should be concerned about it? Then you should probably talk to your doctor and see how it fits into your lifestyle. But generally, moderation. I mean, we talk about this all the time. It's like, you know, if you're never going to be able to drink enough red wine to get all of the resveratrol and the good stuff that's in it to really positively affect you and, you know, keep you from aging. but these factors are in wine, and, you know, small amounts of wine for people who have a healthy diet, it's, you know, moderation. This is my mantra: moderation, moderation, moderation.
You know, Apple's been working on a non-invasive way to measure blood glucose, and it makes one think that one of these days there will be more extensive capability to monitor our blood health. Do you foresee a day when you'll insert a little metal device in your vein? And it has a computer and Wi-Fi, and it monitors your blood, and it says, you need a energy bar now, or you've had one glass of wine. I'm looking at your bloodstream. That's enough. Stop. No more wine. Do you think we'll ever get to that point where we have a blood monitoring chemistry lab inserted into our veins?
Absolutely, but I don't think that we'll have to insert it into our veins. I mean, I think that, you know, if you want to go super sci-fi, there are companies that are working on like fake tattoo type designs for sensors that could be either implanted in your skin or just laid on the surface of your skin to be able to monitor factors.
So it's like a digital circuit embedded in the tattoo like material that's laid on your surface of your skin.
Yeah, and it could just lay on the surface of your skin and take measurements as things diffuse through the layers of the skin. Another idea that's maybe a bit closer is, I mean, For years, diabetics have had to prick their finger to do blood tests to look for glucose or glucose and insulin levels. But there are companies who have been working on the idea of how you can use the proteome, what proteins are in, say, a drop of blood to tell you about your health. And so along those lines, you could potentially have a little device that, you know, sticks into the lightning port on your iPhone, or, you know, if you don't have an iPhone, like I don't, sticks in something in your phone.
Why don't you have an iPhone?
I don't like iPhones.
If you're going to be a guest on this show, you've got to have an iPhone. When I sent you a text message a little while ago, I saw it was green instead of blue, and I went, oh, no.
That's right. Samsung Galaxy.
Oh, well, you're done being one of my guests.
Come on. I think it's the scientist in me. That's why I like my Android devices. But for this idea, you could potentially have a protein blood monitor that is a device that you stick into your phone, an external device, and then you could put your finger on it, and it would poke your finger, take a drop of blood, and run a complete protein scan.
Yes.
To see exactly what's in there, and you'd have an app on your phone that would take all that information in and then send it directly to your doctor.
And look for cancer DNA strands while you're at it.
Absolutely. I mean, yes. Why not? Yes. But these devices are not far off, and I honestly think, you know, we might be seeing the tattoos a little bit later, but I think these little blood droplet phone devices it's going to make it easy for you to monitor your own health from your own home. You don't have to go to the doctor. You can send your information virtually, and the doctor can help you with your health planning, and you never have to go into the office.
You've written or at least discussed recently the relationship between the gut biome and brain health and chemistry. Is there something that you want to talk about there?
Yeah, so there was one study that my co-host Justin brought up recently on the show that I thought was absolutely fascinating. They took a little tiny, it's multicellular, but it's a little tiny sea organism called a hydra. They're little polyps, and they float in the water, and they're basically all gut. They just have like a tube that goes right through the middle. It's a very simple organism. And so researchers wanted to know, okay, let's go back. If we were to kind of do this evolutionary perspective of this is a very simple organism compared to humans, who are a very complex organism, but let's see how bacteria integrate into the gut system of this very simple hydra. And so they got rid of all the bacteria. They basically gave the hydra an antibiotic, killed the bacteria, and the gut of these little organisms stopped working. So in our gut, we have a muscle movement called peristalsis, and it's a rhythmic, smooth muscle contraction that starts at one end of like the stomach and the intestine and pushes down your intestines all the way to the end, to push food, boluses of food, all the way out to the end. And in the hydra, when they got rid of the bacteria, it was completely disrupted. And the only way they were to get it back to even some semblance of what it was previously was to add back multiple different types of bacteria. When they put one type of bacteria in on its own, it didn't do anything, didn't change the activation of the hydra gut at all. And then when they kept adding in new bacteria, eventually it hit a level where the bacteria, they don't know what the interaction is between the bacteria themselves and what they do at a population level.
Wow.
But something happened and it triggered the hydra gut to start working again.
There's an interaction between certain bacteria in the gut and the muscles that cause the peristalsis.
Yeah. And so this is a hydra who's, you know, very distantly related to us, but
probably a lot of our DNA is in common, right?
Yeah, but there's still a lot that we do have in common. And so this is a very interesting discovery, because now we have to wonder, okay, how much of maybe gut problems that people have are related to bacterial imbalances, right? And then beyond that, there were a few other studies that came out at the Society for Neuroscience meeting in October, at the end of October, beginning of November, that the, let's see, they discovered that mice that had a, basically, a, they genetically modified these mice to have Alzheimer's-like symptoms or Parkinson's-like symptoms. And the mice that they had modified to have these symptoms had different bacterial profiles from healthy mice.
Wow. So, yeah, well, and so, and, so we really and, are what we eat.
Exactly, and they were determining that there's a bacterial byproduct of the digestion of fiber that actually is involved in in the process of some of these fibers that are thought to be integrated into Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, and there were a bunch of interesting studies came out, but the bottom line is our gut and our brains are connected, and bacteria play a big part in how they work together and in the health of our entire bodies.
I mean, this be attacked by thinking about a stronger probiotic than just a yogurt, or is that not related? I mean, it's people take probiotics to refurbish their system after they've been sick, or they feel like their gut is not, you know, it doesn't have the bacteria that it needs. But are over-the-counter probiotics an answer, or are they just a scam?
Well, yeah, at this point in time, there haven't been enough clinical trials to really tell us that probiotics beyond just, you know, yogurt-ish stuff, we don't really know. We don't really have that scientific evidence. Anecdotally, there seems to be evidence that they help some people, but we haven't done the, there haven't been the clinical trials yet. And beyond just probiotics, there is the aspect of prebiotics, which is very important. And there is a really interesting study looking at a group of tribal people in Africa called the Hazda, and they have a diet that consists of seasonally available food. They are a remote tribe. They really haven't been influenced by modern diet at all. And they have a completely different bacterial profile than Westerners do. And one of the things they think is different is fiber intake. The Hazda have a much higher intake of fiber in their diet, and they don't seem to have a lot of the gut problems that we have.
This is good stuff, because historically, my perception is that people don't understand the biochemistry of fiber, and they probably think of it as, you know, when they say eat fiber, you know, you should eat yucky stuff, or you should pour some Metamucil and choke on it. And they just kind of steer away from it. And they don't know if they I think if people listen to this show and they understand that, hey, there's something going on between the biochemistry of the fiber and how the bacteria that's created in the chemistry process of digesting fiber helps my gut and so helps my brain and helps my body health. That's a fascinating subject. Are there any books that cover that? Or is this so new that it's not yet?
I bet there are. I would bet there are some books, but it's a fairly new area. I mean, especially looking at the microbiome with respect to diet, it's a fairly new area of study. And there's been some interesting stuff that's been advancing in the last decade or so, but we really still have so much to understand. But the main, I guess the main trends at this point is that processed foods, you know, like your powdered donuts that you buy in the little six pack, little gem donuts or whatever, that's not going to be really good for you on a regular basis.
Yeah, when I'm in the grocery store, I always check the cereal box and look for those, you know, 4 and 5 grams of fiber preserving, and also for bread. Yeah. If your bread doesn't have any fiber in it, don't eat it.
Yeah, you want to reduce your sugar intake. You want to increase your fiber intake. Fresh fruits and vegetables. Eating seasonally, if you can, is also a very healthy way to make sure that you are getting the right kinds of foods into your diet. Yeah, and again, moderation. Come back to it again.
I want to close. We're about out of time.
Darn it. There's so many things.
Boy, does it go fast. Yes, we never get to the whole list. Having an astrophysics background, I was fascinated by something you discussed. I don't remember if it was recently or not. I think it was. But scientists are starting to use the beacons in space called pulsars to see if they can detect gravitational waves. The thinking here is that the gravitational waves generated by colliding black holes warp space, and that interferes with the timing of the pulsar signals that get to us. And if we map the sky properly, am I on the right track here?
Yes, you are.
We might be able to use the disruption of pulsar signals to detect gravitational waves. I think I got that right.
Yeah, and so here on Earth, we've created gravitational wave detectors that we're using to get
LIGO. Kind of
LIGO and Virgo, and they're working together to triangulate the location of these mergers of neutron stars, of black holes, of big, massive objects that, when they smash into each other, create ripples in space-time. But the resolution and the sensitivity of what we can build on Earth, just because of the size of the Earth and, you know, how big of a triangle we can make.
Baseline. Yeah.
Yeah. We can't get that really fine sensitivity or resolution. And so potentially by using pulsars that are dispersed in space, we might be able to see things that are much bigger. So like the merging of supermassive black holes, which as they start to kind of run into each other, send these big low frequency waves through space that are much harder to detect.
That is so clever. So clever. I love that.
That's one of the things that I love so much about, you know, just so many aspects of reporting on these science stories, is the cleverness of the scientists who are coming up with the tools to measure things, and also these new ideas about how to ask questions and then how to test them. And I mean, historically, you know, we couldn't ask that question, a certain question, because we didn't have the technology to be able to do it. And as technology advances, our ability to ask questions advances, and our ability to answer those questions also advances. And right now, I think we are in a golden age for astrophysics and cosmology research. And also at the nanoscale and the human scale, there's so much amazing stuff going on. We're just learning that we still have so many more questions to ask.
Folks, I'm so inspired by Kiki. I hope you are too. Every time she comes on the show, she makes me think, wow, there's so many things to do. I mean, I wish I could live 10 lives all over again and pursue each one of these topics for a lifetime. There's so much cool stuff going on. Well, we're out of time. Again, I want to thank you for being on the show. It's been great to have you. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you for asking me to come back. I do enjoy getting to talk with you about these things.
Oh, I love it. It's great. Folks, I hope you enjoyed listening to Dr. Kiki Stanford and me geek out. And so you've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you again next week.